Hey everyone, hope you're having a great week so far. It's hump day, it's Wednesday. If you're like me, you're looking forward to the weekend so you can chill and relax and just experience what Byung-Chul Han calls inactivity or boredom. By the way, his new book, Vita Contemplativa, is wonderful. I'm really enjoying it and getting a lot out of it, and I'm hoping to discuss it with my good friend and theologian, Phu Lu, in the coming weeks and months. I'm also very excited about this weekend because my wife and I are having some good friends that are coming in from San Antonio, Texas, and we always enjoy just great conversation and connection and drinks with them. I'm even hoping to have a podcast conversation with my friend, Dr. Alan Novian, who's a marriage and family therapist, as well as doing something called neurofeedback. I've had him on the podcast many times before, and we always have great conversations. We're trying to decide exactly what we're going to talk about, but it will probably have to do with something in terms of relationship and communication. We've thrown out the idea of discussing Brené Brown and her ideas around blaming and how we can navigate that. I'm also very excited about this upcoming conversation on Friday that I'm having with Kent Dobson of Hints and Guesses podcast. I think it's going to be a great conversation. We're going to be looking at the idea of what he calls the sacred masculine, and we're going to be in dialogue about Robert Bly's book, Iron John, a book about men. And I think there's going to be a lot in there that could be interesting and intriguing to you as a listener. Now, in this episode, I want to do what I've been doing lately and just read through the latest blog that I wrote. And this was a blog that I threw out there really so that I could sort of collect my own thoughts around what I actually think of the book Iron John, a book about men. And this blog is less about the sacred masculine and more a commentary on Bly's idea that for a man to really enter into mature adulthood, initiated manhood, he has to experience a sharp separation from the mother or the feminine, and he builds on this symbol, this aspect of the fairy tale Iron Hans, where the young boy steals the key from the mother. And this is symbolic of what needs to happen for a boy to transition into adult manhood. And I've got some interesting sort of takes on that. I don't know if we'll get into this as well in my conversation with Kent Dobson, but maybe we will, and we can go a little bit deeper. But here's the blog, and yeah, I hope that you enjoy it. It's entitled The Key as Gift, A Relational Perspective on Iron John. Savage Man versus Wild Man. I'm looking forward to a conversation with Kent Dobson on the sacred masculine. Our conversation will be centered around Robert Bly's book, Iron John, A Book About Men. In this book, Bly uses the Brothers Grimm fairy tale Iron Hans as a way to explore some of the fractures present in contemporary masculinity. Even though written in the early 1990s, I think much of what he says is applicable today. Bly makes a careful distinction between the savage man and the wild man. The savage man is the embodiment of what many today call toxic masculinity. The savage man is one who is angry, aggressive, and destructive. He takes out his inner turmoil on women and wrecks the environment. He is not connected with his sacred depths. Before looking at the wild man, it's important to explore what Bly calls the contemporary soft male, who has reacted against the savage man, but in the process has lost his connection to the soul. The soft male sounds a lot like what my clients call their struggle with the Mr. Nice Guy syndrome. Here are some of the characteristics of the Mr. Nice Guy syndrome: putting the needs of others before your own, assuming that niceness entitles you to romance or sex, becoming angry when niceness is not reciprocated, passive-aggressive behavior as a strategy to meet needs, and lying and deception as a way to win people's affection. Now, Bly interprets the emergence of the soft male, or what my adolescent clients call the simp or nice guy syndrome as an overreaction to the corrective force of feminism. If the savage man attacked the feminine, the soft male incorporated the feminine, but in the process lost touch with his own masculine power. For Bly, the wild man is the epitome of healthy, empowered masculinity. The wild man is connected to his depths, effective in the world, and has learned to integrate the feminine without diluting the masculine. Male dread. In addition to the archetypal perspective of Jung and Bly, I'm also drawn to the relational paradigm in psychology of relational cultural theory. Within this paradigm, one of the obstacles men face is what Steven Bergman calls male dread. According to Bergman, male dread is an emotional process that emerges within men when they are in close relationship with women. For Bergman, the process of dread is relational, not only intrapsychic. While there is, as always, a transferential component, relational dread is not merely a maternal transference. Dread arises not from the woman reminding a man of his mother, but from him being in this relational process where things are happening fast and complexly on both sides, a dynamic where one relational style is meeting another, quite different one. At issue is the process of relationship, not the person, real or transferential. A man's dread is the result of negative learnings about the process of relationship over and over again. Bergman highlights 10 aspects of male dread. Number one, inevitability of disaster. A man's sense that nothing good can come from vulnerable, intimate connection with a woman. Number two, timelessness. A sense that the man will be stuck in this negative state forever. Number three, damage. A belief that the damage done by staying in connection with a woman will be overwhelming and irreparable. Number four, closeness. The closer a man feels to the woman, the more intense the male dread can be. Number five, precariousness. Even if these feelings dissipate, they can resurface at the drop of a hat. Number six, process. Being in connection with a woman feels like uncharted territory. There's no rule book or guidance on how to move forward. Masculinity feels more at home in stasis than in an evolutionary process. Number seven, guilt. Men feel like they are not enough in relationships. Men see this as their fault. Number eight, denial of and fear of aggression. This aspect is connected to the Mr. Nice Guy syndrome. Afraid of being pushed too far or panicking due to the closeness of the relationship, men play it safe and become the nice guy so they don't blow up or hurt anyone. Number nine, incompetence and shame. Men feel like they are not good at relationships, and this creates feelings of inadequacy and inferiority. Number 10, paralysis. These aspects compound and leave the man feeling helpless and hopeless. Separation from the feminine. Where Robert Bly's analysis of the masculine intersects with Steven Bergman's relational cultural approach is around the issue of the young man needing to separate from his mother or the feminine. While the two approaches at first seem opposed to each other, I think there's a way to bring them into an integrated whole. In the fairy tale Iron Hans, the wild man, representing a primal, empowered masculinity, lives in the bottom of a pond in the middle of a mysterious forest. In the story, he's taken out of the pond by the king's men, and he's locked away in a cage. There's a young man in the story, representing young, uninitiated men, and his golden ball rolls into the cage where the wild man dwells. The only way for the boy to recover his ball is to steal the key from underneath his mother's pillow. Bly makes a big deal of the symbolism of the key, representing future access to healthy adult manhood, being underneath the mother's pillow. Bly interprets this as the mother or feminine representing a barrier to the young man's full development. Here is Bly. Mothers are intuitively aware of what would happen if he got the key. They would lose their boys. The possessiveness that mothers typically exercise on sons can never be underestimated. We've all heard the stereotypical trope of the mama's boy. Throughout the history of psychoanalysis, much ink has been spilled over a boy's enmeshed relationship to his mother. Whether that's Freud and the Oedipus complex or Jung and the mother complex, there's been a clear thread tying an unhealthy attachment to the mother slash feminine and a man's stunted psychological development. It's not just psychoanalysis that has highlighted the need to separate from the mother. Bly and others point out primitive cultures and their rites of passage helping young men transition into adulthood. Most, if not all, these rites of passage include an older man or group of older men separating the young boy from his mother and guiding him through a rigorous process of initiation into manhood. It's at this juncture that Steven Bergman takes issue with Bly and others who emphasize the young man's separation from mother. Bergman and other relational psychologists want to underscore the importance of two-way mutual relationships as the core of healthy growth. While differentiation from mother is essential to a young man's development, have Bly and others sufficiently emphasized the need to help men cultivate emotional resilience while staying connected in relationship to the feminine? I don't think they have. Niobe Way describes the crisis of connection for young men in our society. In her book, Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection, she traces the trajectory of disconnection that young boys undergo when they are bullied out of vulnerability and intimate connection. This happens because those relational modes of existing are gender-coded as feminine rather than human. I want to be careful not to caricature Bly and those interested in a depth psychological approach to masculinity. That said, from a relational lens, I think separation from the feminine may not be the right image. Stealing the key from mother may not be the best metaphor. I know Bly underscores the necessity of a sharp separation and the need to steal the key. Nothing else for Bly will propel the young boy to come in contact with a wild man. Bly mentions a New Age audience member at one of his talks who didn't like the idea of stealing and wondered if the boy could just have a conversation with his mother for the key. Bly responds that this is not possible. Bly writes, "No mother worth her salt would give away the key anyway. If a son can't steal it, he doesn't deserve it." I wonder if Bly and other Jungians are describing an unhealthy codependent mother when they should distinguish healthy from unhealthy mothers. As a psychotherapist, I'm the first to admit there are unhealthy mothers who do embody the engulfing traits of the mother that Bly describes. That said, I also know plenty of healthy mothers who want their sons to develop into their authentic self while still remaining in relationship to them. In a toxic relationship between a mother and a son, I think Bly is right to express skepticism about the son's ability to communicate effectively with his mother. In those cases, he may need to steal the key from his mother in order to express his individuation. Most of the enmeshed relationships I see between mothers and sons are usually the result of one of three factors. Number one, the mother's unprocessed trauma. Number two, serious executive functioning deficits that are present with the son's developmental disability. For example, ADHD or autism spectrum disorder. And number three, and this is a big one, I see this probably the most, the father in the family is emotionally vacuous and the mother unconsciously looks for emotional sustenance through her relationship with her son. In a healthy relationship, I think it's possible for the mother to encourage her son to differentiate from her while still staying connected in relationship. In fact, some would argue that genuine freedom and power only emerge within the context of mutually empathic relationships. Integrating depth psychology and relational cultural theory. If you've accessed any of my work, you probably have picked up on the fact that I love putting different theoretical orientations into conversation with each other. I'm definitely not a one theory guy. I see myself as a bricoleur or theoretically promiscuous. At the surface level, I could see how the depth tradition is incompatible with relational cultural theory. Depth psychology focuses on our intrapsychic connection to our unconscious, our archetypal depths. It's an approach that focuses on interpreting dreams and encouraging the process of individuation. Relational cultural therapy, or RCT, is an orientation that focuses on the central importance of interpersonal relationships. The goal of RCT is to help people experience greater zest and vitality through the experience of mutual vulnerability and empathy. While I want to honor the important tensions between these two traditions, I have a few ideas on how to bring them together. An individual journey together. My Jungian psychotherapist would always remind me, channeling Joseph Campbell, that my journey of individuation was something that only I could do alone, yet it was something that I could never do alone. You see, there's an important paradox here. While the depth psychological tradition, or with the depth psychological tradition, I agree that I am ultimately called to reconnect with my soul and the numinous. With RCT, I believe this process can only be facilitated and sustained by the healthy relationships in my life. It's a both and, not an either or. Robert Bly's analysis of the Iron Hans myth incorporates this paradox. At one point, he identifies the wild man as a type of mentor that can help men grow into spiritual maturity. I don't think Bly or others are opposed to the importance of healthy relationships in the process of individuation. The key as gift. The tension comes with the relationship between the young boy and his mother, or the feminine. I do think Bly and others underscore the necessity of a sharp split from the feminine, stealing the key, as a necessary precursor to healthy masculinity. Instead of stealing the key, I have a fantasy of a mother who gives the key away to her son as a gift. She wants her son to individuate into a powerful and emotionally intelligent young man. She acknowledges that she will have to encourage him to differentiate, which will entail a transformation of the current relationship. But the goal is not to sever connection with the boy. By helping her son learn how to communicate with females and respect their differences, she can empower him to find his soul in a way that honors the sacred ties that bring life, joy, and vitality. Instead of feeling dread when close to the feminine, the boy will feel competent in meeting his and others' needs through loving relationship. Okay, I hope that you enjoyed that. I definitely don't want to create a false dichotomy between these two traditions. Like I said in the blog, I don't want to caricature Jung or Bly or even the mythopoetic men's movement. It's something that I'm intrigued by and have found some benefit from. But with my relational orientation, I do feel pretty strongly that it goes too far, or it's just not the right metaphor to describe a man's sharp separation from mother and from the feminine. Following Niobe Way and many others, I think that's a part of the problem for so many men, is that we don't know how to be in relationships, not just with the feminine, but really even with anyone. We don't have the tools or the skills to express vulnerability and empathy in ways that could really heal ourselves and others. So I'm going to continue to push this relational emphasis. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. I really hope that you enjoyed it. Please take the time to give me a positive rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcast. And as always, I want to encourage you to continue the conversation.